All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 670 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be doing something called a quick drug drive-by for step 1, 2, 3. A quick drug drive-by for step 1, 2, 3. Whether you like it or not, you're going to see pharmacology tested on your exams. But again, they have certain ways and means that they love to use to test this material. So I'm going to try to hit on those things so that you're ready for your test. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 55-year-old male and, you know, or female, and she has a history of giant cell arteritis that has been well controlled with pharmacotherapy. And you're told that, you know, for the last 2 months, she has been having very significant, you know, mid-back pain. And then they ask you which of the following is the most appropriate next step. A good answer on your exams actually may be to go ahead and do a DEXA scan. Or a good answer may just be to go ahead and do some kind of spinal imaging to look for osteoporosis. So what's going on with this lady? Well, we know that this person has giant cell arteritis. It's a large vessel vasculitis. And typically, people that have that problem, they have to be on high-dose steroids for a year. For at least a year, right? So the thing is, when you take steroids chronically, that can begin to cause problems, right? So like, for example, it can cause adrenal suppression. In fact, sometimes they can give you a vignette on your exams where you have a person that has a history of, chronic steroid use or Cushing's or whatever. I mean, I'll say chronic steroid use. Chronic steroid use is the big one. Chronic exogenous steroid use. And then you notice that they're having surgery or they have a medical illness or they're in some kind of trauma and they are profoundly hypotensive. And you notice that, man, this person is not responding very well to fluids and pressors. Their blood pressure remains persistently low. Well, it's because those people have some kind of adrenal crisis, right? That adrenal crisis is basically setting them up for disaster. Right? Because again, they've been taking steroids chronically, so their HPA axis is suppressed. So when they face like a stressor, like a medical illness or a recent surgery or trauma, or I guess they're studying for the USMLE exams, that's stressful. They won't be able to raise their cortisol because their HPA axis has been suppressed by the exogenous steroids they use. So for those people, they can have an adrenal crisis and typically they'll require a stress dose of steroids. Now remember, steroids can also cause a person to have osteoporosis. That's why this person is having bone pain and things like that. In fact, the person may have an osteoporotic fracture. Remember, the most common location of an osteoporotic fracture is going to be in the vertebrae. That's actually pretty high yield to know for your exams. So that's why the person has pain. So that's why we're doing spinal imaging or some kind of DEXA scan, right? Because remember, steroids, they can impair the reabsorption of calcium and all these things in your gut, right? And that can cause problems. Right? Or they can even give you a question about a person that has giant cell arteritis and the person has been on steroids for a long time and then they give you an elevated A1C, right? And again, they can ask you for the mechanism behind the person's problem. I would hope that you're thinking about a steroid-induced, insulin resistance, right? So people that are on chronic use of steroids, they can develop hyperglycemia, they can develop diabetes. Right. Again, if you notice, yes, I'm talking about steroids, but do you see how I am making all these integrations? This is something our friends at the MBMEs absolutely love to do. It's something I want to make sure you're prepared for. Again, they don't ask like straight up questions anymore. No, what they do is they take the concept and then they start mixing and mashing it across many other different subjects. Right. And then also remember that, you know, steroids can cause other things, you know, like avascular necrosis of the femoral head. Right. And they can even give you a question about a person that, you know, has completed a year of therapy on, you know, a year of pharmacotherapy for giant cell arteritis. And then you're told, the person's symptoms have been well controlled. You know, they tell you that a recent temporal artery biopsy was unremarkable. And then they say, which of the following is the most appropriate next step to reduce the patient's long-term risk of adverse pharmacotherapeutic effects? That's literally an MBME question right there. You literally want to pick the answer that talks about a gradual tapering of pharmacotherapy, right? So if you've been on steroids for a very long time, right, you need to taper gradually after you've used it in a prolonged, for a prolonged period of time, because you want to avoid an adrenal crisis. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient was recently started on, was diagnosed with diabetes mellitus 2 months ago and was started on pharmacotherapy. And you're told that, they give you this question, they give you the list of the person's medications. And then you're told that the patient, comes in with a significant chest pain, and EKG shows, ST segment elevations and, labs show elevated troponins. And then you're told which of the following adverse reactions should the patient be cancelled about, or which of the following items should be watched while the patient is on admission in the hospital. I'd really hope that you're going to pick an answer that talks about watching out for this person's serum pH, right? Because this person has diabetes, right? This person likely has been placed on metformin. They'll probably even give you that the person has been on metformin, right? So why would you want to check the person's pH? Well, you want to check the person's pH because they can develop a very potent, very powerful lactic acid doses, right? Remember, this is a big problem with metformin. Metformin can cause a lactic acidosis because remember, how does metformin work? Metformin works by inhibiting basically the Cori cycle. It inhibits hepatic gluconeogenesis. Remember, when tissues make lactic acid, they send that lactic acid to the liver to help them convert it back to glucose through gluconeogenesis. And then the liver shoots that glucose back to your tissues. Well, the problem is that gluconeogenesis in the liver, metformin inhibits enzymes in that process. So if you shut down that process, then whatever lactic acid you're trying to feed into the liver almost like hits like a choke point. So those lactic acid levels are going to rise and the person is going to develop a very potent metabolic acidosis. Many people don't realize this, but actually lactic acidosis can be very, very, very deadly. So it's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams. Right? So why is it something we're so concerned about in this person that clearly presented with an MI? Well, if you think about it, when a person has an MI, how do you think they see your coronary vessels very well? They see your coronary vessels very well because they give you all your needed contrast. They give you like crap tons of contrast when you're doing a coronary angiogram, right? So you want to be careful of that drug interaction, right? Because the thing is, iodinated contrast can impair renal function. And if you have impaired renal function, that raises your risk of very, very powerful lactic acidosis with metformin, right? Now, what are some other high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with metformin? Now, remember, metformin, besides the lactic acidosis, right? Remember, it can also cause a B12 deficiency. This is one that, for whatever reason, many resources don't cover, but it's actually very, very high-yield to know for your exams. The thing is, the mechanism there is that metformin kind of alters calcium metabolism in your gut. It literally alters calcium metabolism in your gut. And if you alter calcium metabolism in your gut, then in your distal small intestine around your terminal ileum area, if you don't have enough calcium, it's going to impair the reabsorption of vitamin B12. Because the thing is, B12, when it binds to intrinsic factor, made by the parietal cells in your stomach, that B12, it binds to a receptor, that B12 intrinsic factor complex, it binds to a receptor actually in the terminal ileum, known as cubulin, C-U-B-U-L-I-N. But the thing is, that interaction between intrinsic factor and B12 and cubulin depends on calcium. So if you have less calcium in your gut, that can cause problems because B12 bound to intrinsic factor can literally not bind to cubulin. And if it cannot bind to cubulin, then you'll not reabsorb vitamin B12. So that's how long-term use of metformin can cause a vitamin B12 deficiency. Another drug class that can cause a B12 deficiency that I guess I should maybe throw in here is the chronic use of proton pump inhibitors, right? PPIs, they love to test them a lot on the exams, right? Remember, how do PPIs work? I remember they inhibit that hydrogen potassium ATPase pump that we find in the principal cell of the collecting duct. Whenever you shut down that ATPase pump, or antipod or whatever, it pretty much moves things in opposite directions, right? It pumps out hydrogen ions into the lumen of the stomach and brings in potassium ions. Whenever you do that, that's going to reduce the acidity of the stomach. And the thing is, the acidity of the stomach is actually very useful. Why is it useful? Well, it's useful because it keeps bug populations at bay within the GI tract. I'm going to say that again. It keeps bug populations at bay within the GI tract. So if, for example, you have a situation where your stomach acidity has reduced significantly because you've essentially nuked the parietal cells, then that puts you at high risk of C. diff overgrowth, right? So you can get into trouble that way, right? But you can also get a B12 deficiency because, again, many people don't look at it this way. But the thing is, remember, B12 is found in animal products. This is why strict vegans can develop a B12 deficiency. But the thing is, after you consume that animal product, that B12 is still bound in that animal product. You need to figure out a way to liberate that B12 from the animal product so that it can then pair up with intrinsic factor and then get reabsorbed at the level of the terminal ileum. So the thing that happens here is that you need acidity to separate B12 from the animal products that you've eaten. But if you lack acidity because you are taking a proton pump inhibitor, then B12 cannot be separated from the animal product that you consumed. And that can certainly cause problems. That can certainly cause problems, right? Because basically the B12 is moving through the GI tract, but it's still bound to the animal product you ate. So because it's still bound, it never gets any chance to bind intrinsic factor, and then you end up in hot water, right? Again, remember, proton pump inhibitors also impair the reabsorption of many other things, right? So like, for example, magnesium, right? They can cause hypomagnesemia. Now remember, these things are also associated with magnesium deficiency, right? So they can give you a question about a prolonged QT interval in a person that is chronically using proton pump inhibitors. Think of hypomagnesemia likely as the cause, right? And they can also be associated with osteoporotic fractures. They can be associated with osteoporotic fractures. Again, I highly recommend knowing all these things I've discussed so far for the exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has a history of diabetes, you know, that is, you know, poorly controlled, and that, you know, the patient started having neurological symptoms a few months ago and was placed on pharmacotherapy. And you're told that that pharmacotherapy has helped his symptoms significantly. But you're told that this person is now beginning to have, a paucity of speech. And you're told that this person has, you know, weird rhythmic movements of their eyes and of their tongue muscles. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I'd really hope you're saying, wait, Divine, this sounds like tardive dyskinesia, probably from metoclopramide. Right? Remember, metoclopramide is something that we use. Again, all these drugs you see me talking about, they're very high yield to know for your exams. I'm basically trying to do a drive-by of the most commonly tested drugs on the USMLEs. I have a feeling that this is going to be a part two of this series. But basically, this person is on metoclopramide. Remember, metoclopramide is a drug that is used as a prokinetic agent. Right, it is used as a prokinetic agent for people that have diabetic gastroparesis. Right, it's used as a prokinetic agent. So because it's a prokinetic agent, it causes contraction through the GI tract. You know, it causes peristalsis through the GI tract to keep food moving, right? Because of the gastroparesis that this person has from diabetes. But the problem with metoclopramide is that it basically is a D2 blocker. It's a dopamine D2 receptor blocker. And because it's a D2 receptor blocker, it can certainly cause a person to begin to have antipsychotic-like side effects, right? So don't be surprised if they give you a diabetic and they're developing extrapyramidal symptoms, right? Like, you know, like tardive dyskinesia or acute dystonia or akathisia or things of that nature, right? So the thing is, when people are on metoclopramide, they can ask a prognosis question on your exams and they'll say which of the following factors most strongly influences this patient's risk of developing adverse outcomes with this pharmacotherapy? You want to pick the answer that talks about duration of use. Guys, I'm telling you this. I'm trying to give you examples of MBME vignettes. Again, prognosis is a very, very heavy thing on the USMLEs these days. So make sure you're ready for those kinds of questions. And then obviously, if you have a bowel obstruction, you know that metoclopramide is a big no-no, right? That's a terrible idea. That's a big no-no. I certainly would not put people on metoclopramide for a long period of time, right? So please make sure you're paying attention to these vignettes. These things are kind of important. You know, again, many of these things are off the cuff, but just make sure you know them. I'm telling you based on good experience. Again, remember, I tutor tons of people for the USMLE exams, and I teach tons of classes for the USMLE exams, right? I have my hand on the temperature of this exam. And by the way, before I maybe go to my next topic, if you like the way I teach, you like the way I make integrations, you're absolutely going to love the classes that I teach for the USMLEs. I teach step one to step three classes. They all start next week, Monday. So I have a test taking strategies class that's 2.5 hours long. It's for step one to three. And then on Tuesday, I have a 4-hour biostatistics and epidemiology bootcamp. It's for step one to three. On Wednesday, I have a 5-hour social sciences, quality improvement, ethics, healthcare systems, and hospital medicine class. It's a 5-hour class for step one to three. And then on Thursday, I have a last minute review specifically for step two and step three. And then next week, Friday, and then the following week on Tuesday through Friday, I have a 20-hour very comprehensive step two, step three review that many people have taken and they found to be extremely helpful. I also have a 25-hour step one review that's taking place in the first week of November, and a 50-hour step two, step three review taking place next year. So if you're interested in any of these classes, they are all held over Zoom. They are not lectures, right? They are not lectures. They are based on questions. They are based on integrations. Many people have taken these classes, found them to be extremely helpful. In fact, I've had a recent 270s from people that took literally these classes within the last few weeks. So they're very well put together. I think it's something I'm going to find to be really helpful. All right, so let's continue. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, came in for a joint replacement, you know, because of a severe, you know, car crash. And this person is a 35-year-old male. And you're told that this patient, you know, was intubated, surgery was begun. But that now this patient has, they show you an EKG rhythm strip and you see, you know, a sinusoidal wave EKG. And in some leads, you notice that you see tall peaked T waves. And then they ask you which of the following represents the most likely underlying mechanism behind the patient's presentation. I would really hope that you pick the answer that talks about a genetic mutation. You're like, what? Genetic mutation, Divine, what in the world? Well, what do you think this person has? Well, this person has malignant hyperthermia, right? The thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, they know that everyone and their grandparents have figured out that, ooh, if they give a question and it's an anesthesia situation and the person has muscle rigidity, oh, malignant hyperthermia. They know that everybody knows that stuff. So what do they do these days? The thing they do these days is that they test other antecedents, other outgrowths of malignant hyperthermia. Instead of specifically testing the muscle rigidity, they test more of the sequelae, right? But basically, this person probably got exposed to succinylcholine, or this person probably got exposed to some kind of inhaled anesthetic, you know, like those things like, you know, enflurane and, you know, halothane, although I don't think halothane is really used that much anymore. But this person basically has malignant hyperthermia, right? Remember, if you're exposed to any of these agents and you're a susceptible patient, is a person that has the ranodine receptor mutation, the RYR1 mutation, right? Those people can develop significant problems. Remember, it's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? But you have this ranodine receptor mutation and it causes you to make tons and tons of calcium, to literally not make necessarily, but release egregious amounts of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum of your skeletal muscle. That's going to cause you to have profound muscle contractions, right? And as those muscles go into a hypercontractile state, some of those muscle cells begin to explode, they begin to die. And remember, as cells die, they begin to release the intracellular ions. And what is the most important intracellular ion is going to be potassium. So this person has a very dangerous hyperkalemia that is causing them to have these EKG abnormalities, right? Like tall peaked T waves, white QRS complexes, right? Sinusoidal wave EKG patterns. When you see that, think of hyperkalemia. And then they can ask you, what's the most appropriate next step? You want to make sure you go ahead and give those people calcium gluconate. You never imagine that calcium gluconate would potentially be the answer to a malignant hyperthermia question. Well, look at that, right? You want to do that to stabilize the myocardium. Although I can almost promise you they will not go in that direction on the exams. they will not go in that direction on the exams. They will just go in the direction of you recognizing that it's hyperkalemia, you know, or they can even say that, you know, what's the most likely mechanism behind the EKG findings? And they will give you an answer choice that talks about cellular lysis, right? Because literally cells are lysing, and that's what's causing the problem, right? That's what's causing the problem, right? And again, we're especially worried about this hyperkalemia when you have patients that are burn patients, right? Burn patients, because remember, burn patients have a very high propensity to developing hyperkalemia, right? Because again, a lot of cells are dying and things of that nature, right? So I would highly recommend making sure you understand this. And remember, how do we treat malignant hyperthermia? We're going to treat it with dantrolene and immediate cooling, right? The person has to be cooled as quickly as possible, and you need to give dantrolene. Dantrolene is a ranodine receptor antagonist. It's going to block the release of that calcium from the person's sarcoplasmic reticulum, Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, has a, you know, 4-year history of breast cancer that is in remission, and the person has been on chemoprophylaxis, but you're told that over the last 2 months, the person tells you that she has had very heavy menstrual periods, and, you know, she has been soaking through multiple pads. If you see something like this and they ask you, like, what's the most likely mechanism behind the person's presentation, I'd really hope you're picking the answer that talks about unopposed estrogen exposure in endometrial tissue, right? You're like, again, divine, what's the link? What's going on here? Well, hopefully this makes you think of tamoxifen toxicity, right? Remember, tamoxifen is a SERM. It's a selective estrogen receptor modulator that we use as breast cancer chemoprophylaxis. So why is it called a SERM? Well, it's called a SERM, or again, selective estrogen receptor modulator, because it does different things depending on the estrogen receptor that it's exposed to, right? So like, for example, in the breast, it's a very, very potent estrogen receptor antagonist. In the bone, how does it act? It doesn't act as an antagonist of estrogen receptors in the bone. It acts as an agonist. It acts as a very potent estrogen receptor agonist in the bone. So it actually does reduce your risk of osteoporosis. But in the uterus, on your endometrium, what does it do? It stimulates estrogen receptors in the uterus. And that can cause endometrial hyperplasia. That can cause endometrial cancer. In fact, I can willingly bet that that's why this person in this question has normal final... That's why this person in this question has abnormal uterine bleeding, right? So that's something you want to know, keep at the back of your mind for your exams. In fact, this is part of why we don't prescribe tamoxifen for people that are past the age of 50. If you're past the age of 50 and we need breast cancer chemoprophylaxis, we begin to entertain the idea of aromatase inhibitors like anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, or fulvestrant. So I'm going to say that again, anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, spelled as E-X-E-M-E-S-T-A-N-E, right? Exemestane or fulvestrant, F-U-L-V-E-S-T-R-A-N-T, fulvestrant, right? Because again, those things, right, they're reducing the production of estrogen, because remember, aromatase converts androgens to estrogens. You're literally reducing the production of estrogen. By reducing the production of estrogen, then you won't drive the proliferation of cancers that are estrogen receptor positive, like a breast cancer, for example. So tamoxifen generally is used in women under the age of 50, not in women over the age of 50, right? So this person taking tamoxifen has abnormal uterine bleeding, right? So those people strictly require endometrial evaluation. In fact, if you see abnormal uterine bleeding in a woman that has been on tamoxifen and they, you know, ask you for the next best step in diagnosis or the next best step in management, I would really hope you're picking an answer choice that talks about endometrial evaluation or endometrial sampling, right? So pick something along those lines, right? Endometrial evaluation, endometrial sampling, endometrial biopsy. All right. And remember, compare tamoxifen with raloxifen. I said that tamoxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist in breast, but an agonist in bone and in the uterus. The thing is, raloxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist in the breast, although it's not as good as tamoxifen. That's why tamoxifen is preferred over raloxifen. But another thing to know with raloxifen is that it's an estrogen receptor agonist in bone. So it actually does reduce your risk of osteoporosis. But it is floridly high to know that raloxifen has no effects on the uterus, estrogen receptors in the uterus. It has no effect on those receptors, right? So just make sure you keep that at the back of your mind as you prepare for your exams. And then what if they give you a question about a patient And they tell you that this patient was recently placed on pharmacotherapy for some kind of a malignancy. And then you're told that this person has a very significant pins and needle sensation in the bilateral lower extremities and bilateral upper extremities. But you're told that, the absolute neutrophil count is within the reference ranges and that there is no evidence of myelosuppression. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about vincristine toxicity. Vincristine. Remember, vincristine is a vinca alkaloid. It's one of these chemotherapeutic agents. How does it work? Remember, vincristine inhibits the polymerization of microtubules. It inhibits what? The polymerization of microtubules. You want to be able to compare and contrast this with your vincristine is a vinca alkaloid. You want to be able to contrast this with your taxanes, right? I hope I'm remembering the right drug class. Again, sorry, I'm literally giving this off the cuff. But this stuff is very high yield. I know you may be like, Divine, off the cuff, how can it be high yield? I promise you, I give a lot of off-the-cuff lectures. This is one of those off-the-cuff ones where it's super, super high yield to know for your exams. I've actually been meaning to do this for a while. So your taxanes, remember your taxanes, they inhibit the depolymerization of microtubules, right? So make sure you don't mess this up on your exams. Vinca alkaloids, they inhibit the polymerization of microtubules. Taxanes, they prevent the depolymerization of your microtubules, right? So things like paclitaxel or docetaxel. If I'm getting this wrong in my mind, I'll put this in the commentary on the podcast. But I'm pretty sure that that's the pretty sure that's the case, right? This is just like a diet that people kind of mess up on the exams, right? So back to vincristine and vinblastine, right? So vincristine again is a vinca alkaloid. It can cause peripheral neuropathy. And why do you think it may cause peripheral neuropathy? Well, the thing is, if you disrupt microtubules are absolutely necessary for the proper functioning of neurons, right? You want to move neurotransmitters, you definitely need microtubules to make that happen, right? You want to do like axonal transport in a neuron. Definitely need microtubules for that to happen, right? So if you mess up their polymerization, that's gonna cause problems. That's gonna cause problems with peripheral neuropathy, right? Now, one thing I wanna say is they can ask you which of the following interventions would most likely reduce this patient's risk or would most likely have reduced this patient's risk of developing this adverse reaction. I would really hope that you're gonna pick the answer that talks about dose limitation or reduced cumulative dose, right? This is actually very high yield to know for your exams. And for whatever bizarre reason, our friends at the MBMEs, they like to test this construct specifically with chemotherapeutic agents. You want to do reduced cumulative doses of chemotherapeutic drugs. You basically, whenever a person is on most of these chemo drugs, people actually are, at least the hematologists, oncologists, they tend to actually be pretty smart about keeping the cumulative dose down. It's the cumulative dose that ultimately leads to people developing many of these chemotherapeutic drug side effects, right? So, like for example, this applies with your vinca alkaloids, right? But this also applies with your anthracyclines like doxorubicin and daunorubicin, right? It's a cumulative dose effect. The longer you are on those drugs, the higher your risk of developing that irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So that's one thing I'll certainly know with vincristine, right? Again, weird stuff because many people have memorized the mechanism of action of vincristine, right? I'm probably not adding much value going over that here. Well, I hope I am, at least a little bit. But the thing is, the MBMEs, they found like unusual ways to kind of branch out and test this exact same thing. So something you want to make sure you know for your exams. Now, one thing I also want to say is you want to make sure you can differentiate between vincristine and vinblastine. Those things are both vinca alkaloids, but they can both cause peripheral neuropathy, but vincristine does not cause as much myelosuppression as vinblastine. Vinblastine causes a very profound myelosuppression, causes a very profound myelosuppression. I certainly know those fine differences between vincristine and vinblastine. Vinblastine blasts literally your bone marrow. So I think this drug drive-by, I'm going to go ahead and stop here, literally in episode 671, which I'm going to make within the next day or two here. I'm going to basically continue this series. There is a bunch of drugs I just want to make sure I hit. it, so that from a pharmacology perspective, you're ready for your exams. And by the way, I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. I also tutor for shelf exams. I tutor for the EBIM, Internal Medicine Board exams. I actually just literally finished tutoring someone that just took the exam within the last week or so here. And then I also offer help with ERAS applications, you know, mock interviews, editing personal statements, editing recommendation letters, editing ERAS applications. I've done those for years. Many people I've worked with are like attendings, residents at top flight programs. If you even have red flags, reach out to me. I can probably help you figure out a way to get around those red flags so you can get interviews and still match. And by the way, also check out a book I wrote. It's actually on Amazon. It's called Unusual Career Options for Physicians, right? So if you didn't match into residency, or you quit residency, or you're trying to switch residencies and things like that, I go over some little known career paths that can actually help you make bank as a physician. They basically give you options when you think you may have no options, right? So check that out. The links to all these things are they're below this podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I'll see you God willing, episode 671. And don't worry, I will literally continue this series within a day or two, because this stuff is very high yield information to know for your exams. So have a wonderful day. God bless you. Bye for now. See you next time. Thank you.